Roy Masters, AM, rugby league legend. You wrote a piece recently about the passing of the great Graham Langlands. What was it about Graham that stood out for you?
Well, he was such a versatile player with enormous skill. He traversed three eras of the unlimited tackle period when fullbacks were mainly defensive and he was a great attacking player. Then the four tackle rule, where there were a lot of towering bombs put up and he demonstrated that he could take them very well. And then we move into the six tackle rule, which applies today. And now the fullback is the most important position on the field, and he was the prototype of that particular type player.
Do you think Roy, that he was aware of this at the time? That was he fated, and did were people aware at the time of his importance in this regard?
Well, we all knew how good he was, but he didn't. He was a very shy, a modest, retiring, almost embarrassed about any praise that would come his way. He shunned the limelight, but it was inevitable it would shine on him because he was captain coach of Australia for so many years, and on many occasions single-handedly led his country to victory. And he was also captain coach at St George, the last captain coach that the famous club has had.
Yes, indeed, Roy. And of course, during that era, St George were on a different level almost from the other teams.
That's correct. And St George from 56 to 66 won 11 consecutive premierships, and Langlands played in the final four of them.
Do you think it was? Do you think it was the fact that they had so many players that were willing to go to the line for St George, or was it a star-studded lineup, or what actually happened?
It was a combination of both. They were both star-studded players like Johnny Raper, Rich Gasnier. Langlands, Billy Smith, Papa Clay could always get a team out of trouble, but they also had some big, strong enforcers up the front that played the traditional grueling role, such as Norm Proben, players of that nature that were very, very tough as well.
Indeed. Yeah, well said. Look, Roy, you've got a link, of course, with veterans, as most Australians do, really, if you dig deep enough. Your great-uncle, I believe, was a Gallipoli veteran. Is that correct?
Yes, he was, yes. And he was also a captain of the Australian soccer team, Junior Masters. He was there. My brother Chris Masters, who's written a lot of work for, written a tremendous amount of, and done a lot of documentaries on Australia's contribution to the wars. Including his recent book on Afghanistan called No Front Line. Well, he was telling me that, and I've been to Villers Bretonneux as well, and I have seen a photograph in the museum there of my great uncle. We're very proud of the role that members of our family have played in Australia's military history.
Yeah, that's quite amazing, Roy. And my grandfather was at Gallipoli, and my father in the Second World War, of course, but with your great uncle and the association with Gallipoli, was that known to you when you were growing up? Was that part of the family folklore, if you like?
Well, actually, when I was growing up, and I was born in 1941, the year that Australia engaged in the Pacific War, I was probably more aware of the homecoming of the troops, like 45, 46. I was more attuned to that. And then later I became interested in his role as a captain of the Australian soccer team, even though my disposition at the time was to play rugby league. And then it was only when Gallipoli has been sort of resurrected in the public consciousness as a significant day for Australia, that I began to research his role at Gallipoli.
Okay. And like, I suppose you touched on the soccer thing there too, of course, Roy, and the family has a very strong connection to soccer. You went the other way with rugby. Was there much discourse about that in the family? Or what?
Well, my father, he was a skill teacher post-war up on the north coast of New South Wales,
right.
And it was a very entrenched rugby league territory. And he was obviously keen for me to play soccer, but rugby league was the sport of choice up there. You essentially play with your mates in the same way in the army. You get in a unit, you don't want to leave it. Well, it was the same with me in sport. You'd want to play with your mates what they were playing rather than what your family tradition and history said you should play.
Yeah, you didn't want to be on the outer with your peer group, and if you enjoyed enjoyed playing rugby, then so be it. And of course, it led you to a life that, of course, has included a lot of things. You went down and you coached Western Suburbs in 78. Is that the first year, 78, Roy?
Yeah, I coached Western Suburbs from 78 to 81, and was in 2008 was named coach of the century in that team. Then I moved to St George in 1982, and I was there in 1987. And so we had some good times there, including the 1985 year when we had three teams in the grand final, which had been a rarity in the code.
Absolutely, absolutely amazing. What did you learn from, or I guess going into coaching, and then when you left coaching and looking back, what was your vision, your rear view vision of that?
I now sort of mentor to some extent Craig Bellamy, the coach of Melbourne Storm, and I find that the things that work for me and the principles and qualities that you had to have to be a success remain those same qualities today. And I had breakfast with Craig only yesterday morning, and they're at camp at Geelong. I was talking to him about it, and those two principal qualities that were important for my success and his continuing success, but you know, must be extremely honest with the man underneath you.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, you must have very effective communication, which obviously means that you must know what you're talking about.
Yep.
So pretty much the same as a lieutenant in charge of a platoon or a captain in charge of a company. You know, the men you've got to be honest with them, but also when you give them the advice, the information has got to be very clear. Communication has got to be perfect, but also it's got to be based on accurate knowledge.
Yeah, no, very much like life to itself, Roy. And I guess that's a thing that people will gain respect for is honesty and the truth. And then, of course, it empowers you to do more and, I guess, gives greater vision, which I suppose was your success as a coach.
Yeah, well, it was. And also, when you're a coach too, you've got to embrace the families as well, particularly in my time when we had three grades. Whereas today, the NRL, the AFL, they principally only had the one grade, the top team.
Mm.
But in my day, the responsibility extended all the way. You're sort of de facto got to keep an eye on and protect up to 50 families, 55 families. So
it's a lot of work to be done too. And I have heard a rumour, Roy, that you reckon the players in your day had a better time than the players do now.
Oh, most certainly. We didn't get paid as much, but we had a far better time. I mean, the scrutiny of the media was not nearly as great.
Yep.
No mobile phones and cameras that captured you in embarrassing situations. And we did, unfortunately, get ourselves into a few embarrassing situations, but nothing too harmful.
Mm.
But we mainly perpetrated tricks on each other. But we just still have three or four beers even the day before a game, whereas today, the players are on beer droughts basically from the night after they finish a game.
Yeah, that's right. It's incredible. And I've witnessed the changes in sport in AFL and NRL in regards to player management. And I tell you what, I think, how far can it go, do you think, Roy? I mean, the players being put under the microscope continually, does that, we hear a lot about players suffering depression these days. Do you think that's part and parcel of why there seems to be a rise in depression amongst players under the spotlight all the time?
Well, I think it's a combination of being under the spotlight, but also the intense demands on them, particularly from their families. We've got increasing numbers of Polynesians coming into the game of rugby league.
Mm.
They're expected to be a supply line for the family and their extended family. So there's a lot of pressure put on our Polynesian players from that direction, but also to the simple pressure of maintaining your place in the first grade team. There's a lot of rivals who want your spot, and you've got to stay at the top to maintain that place. So it's pressure from that direction too. There's also the physiological pressure on you. That you've got to maintain a certain weight. Can't let your body weight increase. They put on the scales regularly. Their body fat's measured. That's to some extent why some of them turn to drugs. Not only to as a substitute for alcohol, which can put on weight, but also to sort of lift their spirits a bit when they're feeling a bit despondent. And I just tend to take an old-fashioned view of the increasing use of that depression to a large extent could be caused through an increasing use of drugs. What comes first? Is it the drugs leading to the depression or the depression leading to the drugs? I think it's the former.
Yeah, I know. I'm of the same view. It's the chicken and the egg theory there. But yeah. I think, now, we're talking about sounding old-fashioned, Roy, but here's a line. It's the way that players spend their time when they're not on the field or training, should they be better employed?
Well, they should be. Well, they should be doing a tertiary course. There's an incredibly accurate statistic in the NRL where 80% of the NRL players, that is to say, at the first NRL level and the recently finished under 20 A-League national competition, but 80% of them are involved in either part-time work or tertiary study.
Yep.
Now, the 20% who are not are responsible for 80% of the behavioural problems that the code has had.
Wow.
So the 80% doing something, working or studying, they produce 20% of the debaucheries.
Yep.
20% who are doing nothing, sitting on their bum, just going to training.
Yep.
Responsible for 80% of the debaucheries.
Well, geez, it should be mandatory, I think, because we all know with the work ethic, and again, it's not something that's old fashioned. Work ethic is immortal time wise because you need to be doing something to occupy yourself and to make yourself feel better. And I guess if that's helping yourself or helping others, it's all the same, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. St George, the club where I coach, they've been very good in this direction. They get somebody who's got a degree and they'll pay you additional money to mentor three or four players who are studying for a degree.
Good stuff. Roy, your writing has achieved some notice. You're a good writer. How do you feel with your writing? You enjoy doing that?
I do. I certainly do. I mean, I took a redundancy from the Sydney Morning Herald a few years ago, but they said, no, well, I'll take this redundancy only on the condition that you continue to file for us as a contributor, which I do.
Yeah.
And I enjoy it. I really do enjoy it, and I have very good contacts that are based back over a long period of time. I wrote a story just on Christmas about Tommy Radonikis, the captain of Wests, where I coached, and he's suffering cancer and he's having another fight with his with bad health. But I have enormous empathy with these players, and I like to portray that empathy and give those messages to the wider public to understand, what champions we've had and how we still should love our champions.
Yeah, very well said, Roy. And I think the essence or the strength of your writing is that you make it sound more like a conversation. It's not a challenging situation to sit down and read your material because it is something that is spoken to as you would speak in a conversation. I think that's the essence and that's the importance. So, yeah, well done.
Yeah.
Roy, what about this year coming up? Who's going to be good? Who's going to be bad, team-wise? Who's going to... You picking anyone this early? Or?
Well, I think that when you look at the NRL, the top eight, the top eight from one year to the next really changes, but I think you'll find that this year, within the top eight, the Cowboys will go from... they only got in the top eight as a result of St George getting beaten in the last round. So I think you'll find that that the Cowboys will rise right up from just outside the top eight into the top four, based on the return of Jonathan Thurston and Matt Scott and the purchase of the storefront rower Jesse Jordan O'Neill. Jordan McLean. So they were right. I said, George will make the bottom eight, part of it. Cronulla will be where they were this year, and St George and the Storm will be doing their absolute best to retain their premiership as well.
Yeah.
There'll be some discussion about whether Canterbury can make the and Canberra can make the top eight. The jury would have to be out on that, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, the big mover will be the Cowboys, I think.
Okay, that's fine. And you, what does St George need to get back up there?
Well, the two things that they need is a creative, an organising halfback, which they purchased from Brisbane in Ben Hunt,
mm-hmm.
and a fairly aggressive front rower. He's not as aggressive as he once was, nor as skillful as he once was, but the guy that they brought over from James Graham, they brought over from Canterbury, he'll certainly add some maturity and discipline and leadership to the Dragons pack.
Thanks very much for that, Roy. All the best for you and the coming season, and I look forward to reading your pieces in the Sydney Morning Herald.
Okay, mate. Good on you. Thanks very much for that. I really enjoyed talking to you.
I did too, mate. Take care. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, mate.
Bye-bye.